A new documentary about an abstract expressionist painter by the name of Albert Bloch began with a simple question. What was this guy who'd been at the center of the modern art world in Europe doing in an attic in Lawrence, Kansas at the end of his life? He'd been living in Lawrence for years in relative isolation, and nobody really knew why. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're going to hear that story now. My first guest is the filmmaker behind the project, Tim DePape. Hi.
Hi.
Your documentary is just called AB. Why is that?
Because AB was the popular kind of moniker that friends and family used to refer to Albert Bloch. So he liked that. He accepted it. That's also how he signed his paintings.
So when did you first learn about Albert Bloch? How did you first learn about him?
Well, I first learned about Albert Bloch in 1996. I was approached by the artist's grandson, Scott J. Bloch, and who wanted to make a film about his grandfather. I had a background and a real passion for art history when I was an undergraduate at KU. And I was also a film major, so it was really kind of a natural fit for me. But I will say that Scott's enthusiasm and passion for his grandfather's legacy to the birth of modernism is very infectious. So that got me going.
Take me back to those conversations, because that must be such a strange experience to have someone approach you about an artist you don't know about and be like, this is my grandfather. He's a big deal. No, let me tell you more. Really, he's a big deal, I swear.
Well, it was an interesting timing because it was right at the time when there was a big exhibition that was breaking in the 90s. That exhibition was at the Nelson Atkins here in Kansas City, the Lumbach House in Munich, Germany, and the Bloomington, Delaware. And so there was a little bit of notoriety.
Started building up.
But it was kind of a surreal conversation. As I met Scott at this coffee shop, which is now defunct in Lawrence, Kansas, and he and I were having this conversation about doing this film, it was just real weird because this coffee shop was sort of like a center hub of a lot of people walking in and out. And James Graverholtz and William Burroughs walked in during that time. So
that's funny because I was going to say, like, Lawrence does have this isn't the only character where it's like, this is this famous person and it's kind of mysterious. What are they doing here? William Burroughs being the other name I kind of think of along those lines. And I wonder what you think. Was there a lot of curiosity in Lawrence about Albert Bloch?
I think people, there was a general population, a group of people who knew who Albert Bloch was and always kind of have since, you know, he moved there. But in terms of his real legacy and his real contribution to the origins of modernism and who some of his main cohorts were when he was in Germany, I don't think a lot of people were really had a full grasp and understanding of that.
Okay, let's get a full grasp and understanding of that. Hang on with me. I am excited to hear about the twists and turns your research ultimately took. But first, I want to learn more about the significance of Albert Bloch. We've got art historian David Kataforis with us now. He's joining us from KU. Hi, David.
Good morning, Gina. Hello, Tim.
Hey, David.
So let's start with a quick synopsis, the life of Albert Bloch, paragraph style.
Right. Well, his main claim to art historical fame is that he was a member of the Blue Rider Group in Munich before World War I. The leaders of that movement were Wassily Kandinsky and Franz Marc, who were two of the huge names in expressionist painting in European modern art. He was born in St. Louis, studied painting some, but started his career as an illustrator before he went to Munich with his family and took up painting and fell in with the Blue Rider artists. Then he stayed in Munich through the teens, exhibited widely in Europe.
The 19-teens, right?
Exactly. So between 1909 and 1920, except for a brief return to the U.S., he was in Europe and established himself there as a modern artist. But then he came back to the U.S. He taught for a year in Chicago, and then he ended up in Lawrence He headed the KU Department of Drawing and Painting from 1923 to 1947, and he remained in Lawrence for the rest of his life. He died in 1961. So he really spent the majority of his career in Lawrence.
You know, I wonder if you can explain the Blue Rider, what it was, and perhaps more importantly, to me anyway, why it was called that?
Okay, the origin of the name, the color blue was a symbolic color for both Kandinsky and Mark, and they associated it with heaven and with spirituality. And the symbol of the rider derives from St. George, the knight on horseback, the Christian knight on horseback who slays the dragon and is on the city emblem of Moscow. And Kandinsky was a Russian from Moscow who spent several years in Munich. So you can think of the Blue Rider as a kind of spiritual knight battling against materialism. And I think that's a good sort of encapsulation of the philosophy, certainly of Kandinsky and to some extent Mark and Bloch as well. They saw art as a spiritual pursuit that was seeking to transcend or battle against materialism.
Materialism, so I think, in what form in the 19-teens?
Well, if you want to sort of keep it within the artistic context, the idea of the realism in art, the idea of trying to represent the world accurately and faithfully with almost, you know, scientific precision, they felt that was misguided. They felt that art should instead be a more expressive and creative pursuit. The idea of expressionism is that the artist is not seeking to imitate nature, but to convey internal feelings and desires. So that, I think, is their fundamental philosophy.
Can you describe the paintings of Albert Bloch, or if it's easier, pick a painting by Albert Bloch and describe it, just to give us a sense of what they look like? I know this is hard on the radio.
Right. Well, he painted for several decades, so his style changes. The work that's best known is the work from the 19-teens, painted when he was in Munich. And you'll see he painted landscapes, he painted figures, he painted still lives, he painted standard subjects, but in the 19-teens, you'll see the influence of cubism, so the forms may be fragmented or treated in more geometric terms. He'll use bright colors that don't imitate the appearance of nature. The space may be compressed or fragmented. So if you know anything about, say, the paintings of Franz Marc or other Blue Rider artists, you'll see elements of that in Bloch's work. Then in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, when he's in Lawrence, and I think doing his most original work, he again is painting typical subjects, landscapes, still lifes, figure paintings. He paints a lot of Christian imagery, which is something we could talk about. But he's using very complex space, breaking the space up, using transparent or translucent forms. His palette in the later years is earth colors and blue and white, so he's got a reduced palette. And he uses a lot of white on the surface of the painting so that it has a sort of gossamer surface quality that we often think of as a kind of spiritual emanation that is animating his imagery.
What is all of that about? Yeah, what was going on in his life that he was reducing his palette to these earth tones, blue and white, and that he was trying to evoke this spirituality in the materials he was using?
Well, I can't really explain his color choice, but I can say that he did see art as a spiritual pursuit, as an ethical pursuit, not as a means of earning a living or making money, but as a means of pursuing some sort of fundamental truth about the human condition and maybe an aspiration towards the infinite. Now, those are very lofty terms, but Bloch was committed to them. So I think that his creative pursuit was driven by a kind of spiritual quest. And I mentioned the Christian subject matter. Although he came from a Jewish background, he was not raised in the Jewish faith, and he adopted a personal form of Christian belief. He didn't go to church, but he read the Bible. So I think that he was, you know, a religious and spiritual person who sought to convey those kinds of transcendent values through his art as well as his poetry. He was a very prolific poet as well.
Did he maintain ties with the other members of the Blue Rider art movement in Europe, or did he move to Lawrence, Kansas and sort of become, you know, more of an individual painter, just adrift?
He rekindled those relationships in the 1930s. By then, Franz Marc, who was his closest friend in the Blue Rider Group, was long dead. He died in World War I. But Bloch took up a correspondence with Vasily Kandinsky. He also wrote to Paul Klee, and he wrote to Maria Marc, Franz Marc's widow. He was also in communication with a Viennese publisher and literary critic and satirist named Karl Kraus, who was in Vienna. So he maintained ties to the European intellectual community from his base in Lawrence. He was physically isolated, but was in contact with these other creative and intellectual individuals elsewhere.
You did pioneering research on this guy, and I want to talk about that for a minute. I mean, you moved to Lawrence and found out about him, and what happened? Because this is, you arrive in Lawrence and kind of get this opportunity to understand what to the art world is kind of an enigma, not just to Lawrence, to the whole art world.
Right, and I was not alone in that pursuit. When I came to KU, it was 1992, and within a year I had been drawn into the Bloch world by Frank Baron, my colleague in the German department at KU, who is now retired. And Tim can speak to this, the magical experience of going to the house at 1015 Alabama to be greeted at the door by his widow, Anna Bloch, who would take you up to the third floor. Where he had a studio, and she had all of his paintings and watercolors and drawings there, neatly organized, and you'd sit up there for hours with her just looking at the work and talking about it. She also had his library, she had his papers, she had the whole archive. Now, by this point, the Nelson Atkins was already involved with research on Bloch, Henry Adams, the curator there, Scott Heffley, the paintings conservator there. So there was this momentum leading up towards the 1997 exhibition that Tim mentioned. And Frank Baron had enlisted a lot of scholars to work on Albert Bloch, and I ended up co-editing a book with Frank and another scholar of literary and artistic studies on Bloch. So there was a lot of scholarly activity surrounding Bloch in the 1990s, but I was privileged to be in Lawrence, and particularly privileged, as was Tim, to know and talk with Anna Bloch, who, was kind of the major source of knowledge about her late husband. She devoted the rest of her life to his legacy after he died in 1961.
So, Tim, jump in here. Tell me about your experiences as well, because I understand we've heard sort of the timeline of Albert Bloch's life, but now as we're sort of entering his house with his widow, I feel like we're starting to get into Albert Bloch, the human, the person, which I feel like you had some experiences, too, that kind of...
Yeah. One of the sort of visual goals of the film, and hopefully people can will see the film, come see it this Friday, is that we wanted to experience looking at paintings in kind of a unique way. And one of the things that we do is we were fortunate enough to get Albert Bloch's widow, Anna Bloch, on camera while she was still with us. And we have hours of footage of David and Bob Sudlow and a few other people in the attic looking at paintings and discussing it. So that is a unique visual experience that's in the film. But for me, I think Bloch is a... He's kind of a cautionary tale in many ways because his message is sort of... He cautions other artists in many ways.
Cautions them about what?
I think that there's too many temptations out there. And I think the temptations, such as? Well, the art world, the art business community and things like that. He's not speaking directly to those sorts of things. But I think if you look at Bloch's work and you look at some of the messages, there's one particular painting I like. It's called Prologue to Heaven, which is a later work of his, which is sort of an interpretation of Faust with the character Job from the Bible. And I think he seemed to be very self-aware. And talking to Anna and
can I just jump in and say, yeah, it sounds to me like he's someone who had access to all the trappings of fame, at least within the world of intellectuals and artists.
Well, yeah. When he returned from Germany, he had a really good exhibition at the Daniel Gallery in New York, and Arthur Jerome Eddy in Chicago was a big fan of his work, and in fact thought of him as like probably the greatest American painter at that time.
And so he had access to all of this, but chose to live out his remaining years pursuing art in a really different kind of way.
He is unique in that respect, in that a lot of his sort of isolation, was sort of the term thrust on him, was self-imposed. In many ways, he did make a very conscious choice.
And so I guess I wonder if that's part of the cautionary tale that you're talking about. David, jump in here.
Well, to reinforce what Tim said, when Bloch came back to the U.S., he did have this big show in New York at the Daniel Gallery, and it had some reviews. He had some sales. But he, by that point, had really become disenchanted with the commercialization of art, with viewing art as a commodity and with having to promote yourself, you know, as a kind of cultural producer. So when he got the job at KU, I think he was liberated. You know, he had his salary, he had his teaching work, and then in the summers and the evenings and the weekends, he could do his own creative work. So maybe what Tim is talking about here is the idea that Bloch is a model for an artist who turns his back on the commercial side of the art world and concentrates just on creativity.
This is, you know, Tim, as an artist of a kind yourself, you're a filmmaker. Mm-hmm. How does that sit with you?
I'm not quite sure. I mean, how does it sit with me?
Yeah.
I think Bloch is an amazing story in general. It's because there are many twists and turns in terms of deconstructing the kind of paradox of art fame. You know, I think that's one of the most fascinating kind of elements about Bloch's story. There are many different kinds of little through stories and kind of tangents in Bloch's life that I would have just loved to have kind of delved into and gone into, but it's only one movie, and there's only so much I can do in one film. But, I mean, there are...
Give me an example of one of these little twists and turns.
Well, there are... themes about Faust, I mean, and images of Faust throughout all of his work, even starting...
And that would be about selling your soul to the devil.
Kind of, yeah. In terms of that started even when he was a young man in St. Louis, Missouri. I mean, you know, it's throughout all of his work, he had these sorts of images. So it just denotes a kind of self-awareness. He had a son who became a very popular television writer in Hollywood, wrote for... you know, television for High Chaparral, you know, and all these big major Westerns. And if you kind of look at that, you know, the differences between two generations, father, son, and the kinds of different work and different art that these two men created, there's all sorts of different, there's just many, 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 many just elements. Like I said, I could go on all day about it.
David, you had some, I mean, both of you, it sounds like, had some experiences where your research itself became quite unconventional, in that the source wasn't a book or a file in a cabinet somewhere, but a human being, the widow of this artist, and that the space that you're working in isn't a pristine research facility, but an attic. David?
Right. Well, Anna didn't like to call it an attic. She called it the studio. she was pretty particular about that. But it was so valuable, Gina, to be able to just sit there and look at pictures with her and talk about them. And, you know, occasionally she would remember something that A.B. had said about a picture, or she would remember the circumstance in which it was painted. And I made notes, you know, which are invaluable to the researcher. At the same time, she always insisted that if you wanted to know what A.B.'s work was about, you had to look at the work itself. She would always say that whenever someone would ask A.B. what the painting was about, he would say, "Don't ask me. I only painted it. Ask the picture."
Did you have that experience of being told that, and so consulting a painting and like summoning information?
Well, I believe in close looking at the work of art and trying to derive meaning from its forms, its subject matter. I've written a lot of close descriptions of Bloch's pictures that seek to seek to put in words their expressive qualities, to make verbal the visual. So I was already in tune with that kind of approach. And I'll say furthermore that that's pretty common in modern art, the idea that the artist leaves the work open to the viewer's interpretation rather than trying to dictate its meaning.
Can you give us an example of some of these making verbal what you saw visually?
Well, I wrote an essay for the Nelson Atkins Lanebach House exhibition, and also for the book that I did co-edited with Frank Barron and Helmut Arntzen. I wrote an essay in which I describe at length a painting called Passing Train from 1947 to 48, which Bloch painted. You can't see this on the radio, but I'm opening up an illustration of it. Bloch painted this after he had had a heart attack and retired from teaching at KU. And it was based on his memories of spending summers in Connecticut with Anna Bloch. So that's the kind of biographical context. But just looking at the painting with this amazingly dense landscape of trees and plants and rocks and streams, these glowing figures, the cloudy nocturnal sky, the train passing in the distance, I went in and looked as closely and carefully at the picture as I could and tried to find language that would evoke those visual and iconographic features. So that to me is as probably my greatest joy in working on Albert Bloch's work is being able to write about these pictures that in many cases had never been written about before.
Yeah, and I'll just jump in there. I mean, the painting that you're discussing is actually in Passing Train, and that painting is featured as a prominent section in the film. That's a very, very – we named one of the chapters in the film after that.
Why?
Because I was just echoing what David said. I think it was a very, very important part of his work in terms of his legacy.
So – for you, Tim, as you get ready to screen this film in Lawrence this Friday.
This Friday, 7 o'clock at the Lawrence Arts Center.
I'm wondering about what it's like for you to sort of release this 20-year project, this documentary you've created, this 20-year experience of diving into someone else's life and someone else's art, to get ready to release that to the public and let go of it a little bit?
Oh, gosh. There's just not enough time to really answer that question. But I think anyone who has come in contact with Albert Bloch, David can speak to this, Scott Heffley, who's featured in the film, even Frank Barron, many people who have gotten to know Anna Bloch and been sort of touched by Albert Bloch's legacy know that Albert Bloch is at times not really just a passing interest. He can take over you and can become a bit of an obsession.
Well, Tim DePape, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And David Kataforis, chair of the Art History Department at KU, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The documentary AB about the life of Albert Bloch will be screening at the Lawrence Arts Center this Friday. I'm Gina Kaufman. Central Standard continues in just a minute. Calvin Arsenia is a Kansas City musician, and it's hard to put him neatly in a box. That is part of his appeal. You can't pin him to a genre or even a specific instrument. He used to be known for being a harpist, but now his vocal stylings and sense of performance are at least as big a part of his signature sound and impression. Well, his new album, which he recorded with a star-studded band in California, is called LA Sessions. There's an album release show at the Record Bar this Thursday, and you guys, this album is really good. Calvin Arsenia, good morning.
Good morning.
Tell me about the making of this new album.
Well, the LA Sessions is, we revisited a few songs and then tried to do a couple new ones as well. And it was with my label called Center Cut Records. And they invited me to dinner and just asked me what my dreams were. And I kind of was pretty open with them and dreaming.
Yeah, what did you say?
Well, I said that, you know, one thing that I've been able to do a lot of is play with my friends. And I love that. And it's been a really... It's always a pleasure to work with them and to work with people here in Kansas City. But there's also a different kind of feeling of working with people in other parts of the world, and specifically in places where the industry is more rigorous. And so they said, you know, what is something that you have not been able to do yet? And how can we help you do that? And I said, well, I would love to record with some musicians in LA. And I kind of left it at that. And Jim Andrews went and found a producer. And
it sounds like... You know, like your fairy godmother appears and says, like, what do you want? Like,
kinda, yeah.
I shall make it happen.
But there's also just something really beautiful about being open about your dreams and communicating them and, you know, ask and you shall receive, you know, and if you don't vocalize what it is that you want to do, then it will never happen. So
for an artist whose last album was such a love letter to Kansas City, I wonder if there's any greater meaning in that, or no, just a new opportunity, a new...
Well, with the LA sessions, I like to take life by the horns, and I love Kansas City, and I grew up in Olathe, and, you know, there's such an appeal to the openness that is here and to the ability for artists to make a name for themselves or to make a world for themselves and to make to not have the pressures of finances as much as it is on the coasts. You know, I have been lucky enough to be able to be a full-time musician and artist for the last 4 years and teaching here and there, but primarily, you know, all of my income comes from the stage. And so I'm grateful for Kansas City for that. And LA has a beautiful energy, and so does New York and other places as well. I've spent a lot of time in San Francisco, but Kansas City will also always be home.
As I mentioned just a little bit ago, there's some real star power in the band you recorded with. I understand your producer set that all up and you didn't even know before heading out.
Yeah, I'm sort of... painfully oblivious, but I think I like to use that to my advantage, where I'm just taking people as they present themselves, and not for necessarily their track record. Although, you know, your reputation is important, but these were okay. All lovely men, so,
which is wonderful that's what you cared about. I do want to let our listeners know that you were recording with people who also played with Etta James, Aretha Franklin. Were you totally freaking out when you did learn that?
I just try to keep my cool. but what it comes to me, though, is that you have these amazing musicians who are humble and who are hardworking and who know how to get out of the way and to follow the muses. And I felt so much respect from them, and I felt so much camaraderie with them. I mean, we were laughing a lot during the sessions, and just telling jokes and telling stories. And to me, that's the most important part.
So we're going to hear more about your story and what this album signals in your life and your career, but I think we better let our listeners hear some music. I want to play one of my favorite songs on LA Sessions. It's called Dying. Mm-hmm. Sounds morbid for a favorite, but whatever. Anything you want to say about this song before we play it?
Yeah, this song was first recorded for my album called Catastrophe, but this is a version, and I wanted to have it feel very soulful and very alive, and I think they did a great job.
Okay, let's listen to Dying from LA Sessions.
You'll have to scrape me off the ground. All these lies been bringing me down. Been forced to act like I don't care. But I've been bleeding everywhere. And now I'm dying. I'm dying to love you. Yes, it's true. It's true. Oh, I'm dying.
Calvin Arsenia, this song sounds a little bit churchy to me, and I understand the church is a huge part of your background. Feel free to tell me if I'm imagining churchiness here, but I do hear a choir, and I wonder if you can speak to that.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up leading worship all over Kansas City, and Olathe in particular, and which was mostly playing acoustic guitar and singing songs in small groups of people. But the gospel influence, I would say, is more from my mother. And as funny as it sounds, she would play all of her favorite gospel music every Saturday morning when we had to clean the house.
That sounds like it would make the chores go by faster.
Yeah. But it's all just very, very emotional and passionate music. You know, people rendering their souls before an uncreated being, and so everything. I mean, the music, the drums, the organ, the singers, is with every fiber of their being. And I think that is something that's always inspired me as a musician and as a creative person.
You know, you've mentioned you're from Olathe, but you also spent some time in Scotland as an adult. And an article I read in The Pitch says that you kind of see your life as being divided into before Scotland and after Scotland. Can you explain that?
Absolutely. Before Scotland, I was very, I was very timid and very, even more shy than I still am. And I was really looking for my voice and what my contributions were, to whatever, just, you know, finding out who I was as a person. And my journey there, being around people who had also kind of left their families or left their home lives temporarily, a lot of young adults there who I call adult orphans, we were all just creatives kind of trying to find our place in the world. And
what were you doing in Scotland?
Yeah, my main purpose there was working as a missionary in a church. So I was there as kind of an outreach person, a liaison between a local body of Christians and the city. And my job description was to create or listen to stories and create art or events around people and using collaboration as a way to build bridges. And from that, I just really found that I was not living my true self completely, and I wanted to not be a hypocrite. So I decided to ultimately leave the church at the time. And
can you explain what you meant when you just said that you didn't feel like you were being your true self?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I felt that that there were questions in my mind, and there were things that I you know, my lifestyle, particularly as a homosexual, was not invited into the Christian community that I was a part of. And I had seen so many people in the media be beheaded, I mean, socially, kind of, because they had come out later in life. And so I decided that I wasn't going to live that story and that I would just do it on my own and find a community that would support me in that process. And I feel like I did the right thing.
So how long did you stay in Scotland, and where do you feel like the sort of after part left you? You know what I mean? Like, what was different about Calvin after Scotland?
Well, Calvin before Scotland was happy to play acoustic guitar, singing in a corner of a coffee shop. And after Scotland, I'm singing on stages with circus performers as a consistent way of life. Just got back from Homer, Alaska with Quixotic, and that was awesome. I'm always playing with different genres of music, playing with different costumes and makeup and jewelry, and really just trying to live a life out loud, one that's not characterized by the shame that I was so familiar with.
There's another song from LA Sessions that I want to talk about. The song is Poseidon. It's got some really, really sexy stuff going on in it. And it is very overtly about a man. You're not leaving that to the imagination.
Correct.
Can you talk about doing that? That's a first for you, right?
Yeah. So for a long time, I used to write songs about men that I was interested in or was in love with, and I would change the pronouns because I was afraid to be seen. And this song actually, you know, and that is a lifelong, ongoing process. I'm going to just say that, because when I was in the studio recording this song, there are parts of this song that I concealed until we were actually recording. And
when you say concealed, like, you just when you were practicing, you didn't sing those parts?
Correct.
So did you have some master plan to just, like?
Yeah, I just knew that the recording was going to be fine. I just didn't want to, I didn't want too much commentary. I just wanted to record the song, and so at least we got one take before before they started making. I mean, but everyone was lovely. So that and it's kind of just like, you know, an admission to being still very insecure sometimes, especially in a room full of strangers, and a room full of strangers of people who could, you know, have the prerogative to get up and leave. You know, so I just wanted to get the song down first
and not scare them off.
Well,
let's hear Calvin Arsenia's Poseidon with that dramatic build-up.
You and your trident have been awful nice to me lately. You have a kingdom and a wife and a baby, but you make time every night. I can't stop thinking about you. I don't know what it is. You're just an ordinary man. Can't stop thinking about you. I don't know what it is, but I don't miss the violin.
I can't put my finger on it. I can't put my finger on it.
So Calvin, we're not going to hear the last line in the song, but I feel like that's what you're referencing.
Yeah.
We'll let that be a surprise.
No, that'll be a surprise
for our listeners. But I am curious, you know, this room full of, like, as we've said, heavy hitters in the music industry,
yeah,
who are not of your generation. They're from more olden times, I guess, would be a way to put it.
Experienced.
Yeah, they're experienced. Yeah. And I wonder how they did react.
Yeah, I mean, so the last line comes, and then we all just held our breath until the final sound was over, and then the engineer hit done, and then we all just burst out laughing, and it was really lovely. I mean, these guys are in LA, and they've been in the industry. I'm sure that they've seen everything, and so nothing will actually surprise them. But I just felt insecure. That's that.
It seems to me that with your sound and your aesthetic, you have really created a kind of world of your own to inhabit. And it contains bits and pieces of so many different influences, but it doesn't feel like a patchwork of those things. It feels like its own separate thing. Like you put the church experience and the funk sound and a classical sound and the harp and even a little jam band. Enis.
Yeah.
And you put them into some kind of chemical reaction, and now they're Calvin. And when it comes to some of the more challenging chapters in your story, I imagine that's incredibly healing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I often have said that and do say that in places or things that topics that I don't like to talk about in a one-on-one basis, they become very easy to talk about on the stage. And in the stage, it's designed that you present something and the audience claps. And so, whereas in a conversation, the conversation could go so many different ways.
And people rarely clap, although you just gave me the idea that that would be a lovely thing to do more often.
Yeah, no, you know, because especially with things that are as divisive as lifestyle or sexuality or politics or religion, even, you know, it's hard to talk about those things, but experiencing the music behind it or experiencing a story, no one can disagree with your experience. No one can disagree with your story. And so rather than trying to recruit or say anything or evangelize or anything like that, I'm just trying to tell my story in a way that feels safe.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. We'll get right back to this conversation with Kansas City musician Calvin Arsenia. His new album is blowing my mind, so we will hear more music and more of his story. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm joined by musician Calvin Arsenia. His new album, LA Session, comes out this week. There's a show this Thursday at the Record Bar, and attire is Hollywood Magic.
Mm-hmm.
Hi again, Calvin.
Hello.
What is Hollywood Magic?
I don't know. I just want everyone to come out looking their best.
Maybe a little glitzy.
A little glitzy, a little glam. Anything that you have that you already, especially things that you already have that's been sitting in your closet that you need an excuse to wear, I think you should come with that.
This is the excuse.
There may or may not be a paparazzi waiting for you. Just come. Come dress your best.
So there are a few covers on this album, and I want to play one. Don't Explain. Talk to me about the song itself and what you did to come up with your own take on it.
As somebody that sings a lot of other people's music, I always try to really embody and feel the you know, all of the circumstances that would have been around somebody having to write this song. And to me, music is medicine, and music is healing, and music is like a salve for the soul. And I often imagine that different sounds and different language is like in little jars in the, behind a, an apothecary, you know, and that like as a mixture of them, they create the perfect tincture for whatever it is that ails you.
And so what's ailing someone when they write Don't Explain in your estimation?
I imagine that it says don't embarrass me. I know that you've trespassed, and I know that you've done things that you knew better than to do. We both know that. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to hear about it. Just don't embarrass me in public. And I don't think that there's a lot of songs that have this sentiment. There's a lot of songs that say you've hurt me or I love you, but there's not a lot of songs that say don't embarrass me, you know? And so I felt that this was a very powerful song, and progressive for its time. And, you know, Billie Holiday being the first artist to present it, and one of the writers as well.
So we will hear you singing this, but I want to say you at once absolutely don't sound like you're trying to be Billie Holiday when you're singing the song. There are a couple of moments, though, where I feel you channeling her just for a split second. And sometimes it's in a note that just you're at one note and you just go a little bit lower for a second.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, I just tried to feel it in my bones and sing from there, and know that I will never be Nina Simone or Billie Holiday, and that, you know, what would they do? And they would just be themselves. And so I tried to do that.
Okay, this is Don't Explain, Calvin Arsenia's version from LA Sessions, that's out this week.
Quiet, baby, don't explain. You've got nothing to gain. Just skip that lipstick. Don't explain. You know that I love you, and my love endures. All my thoughts are of you, for I'm so completely yours. Don't wanna hear folks chatter, 'cause I know you cheat. Right and wrong don't matter when you're with me, my sweet.
The vocal range on this song, you really get to explore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of, it sits in a higher place, but it's really gentle too, which is a new sound for me.
So when I talked earlier about that, it feels like musically you are creating your own world. You also do a lot of collaboration. How do you welcome other people into that world and work with them in making it real?
Well, if there's one rule for the world that I'm creating, or the world, I mean, I'm trying to actualize the world that I want to live in and that I want to be reality. And in that world, you're allowed to tell your story without judgment, and you're allowed to come in with your own experience. And the most important thing is that you're being authentic to yourself, and that authenticity is the thing that we value more than skill or precision. It's about living your authentic self and your authentic life. And so I love to work with people who do all kinds of things. And basically I just say, you know, what would you like to add to this? You know, what is your contribution? That's like a soup or a stew that we're all making together. And you bring some potatoes or you bring some parsley. Like, they're both valuable, and we want them, and they're welcomed, and I want them. And I want to see what it is that your flavors will change in mine or bring out in mine. And that's always a fascinating process. But I don't give a lot of direction, because that kind of defeats the purpose of collaboration, I think.
When you come, you know, to the point where this album is out in the world and people are dancing at the show at the record bar and stuff like that, then it'll be, I'm guessing, at some point time to think about what's next. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you were sitting in that same meeting where someone said, what could you do next? What do you want to do next? Anything. And you gave the answer before, go and record with some musicians in LA. What would your answer be now that you've done that?
Oh, gosh. I have been really fortunate to do a lot of amazing things. And, you know, where I want to kind of look next is really composing for large ensembles of musicians. And hopefully to, and I'm thinking particularly with strings or a more orchestral outfit, and like leaning into my classical training, and that's really what I would like to explore next, I think, is getting into playing with symphonies, writing for them, orchestras, I mean, and writing for them and singing in front of them. Yeah.
When you also talk about your journey being toward living more and more of your authentic life and becoming more and more comfortable living your most authentic life, what is still hard about that at this point? Because it's, I think from the outside, it would be easy to hear your story and be like, wow, I mean, this guy's made it. He's got nothing, like nothing to lose anymore. Like,
yeah. I try to always be somebody who's building bridges, and so therefore I try to be empathetic, and I try to listen and look at other people's stories. And you know, there are a lot of people, it's a very divisive time to be alive, and I think more so now than ever because of social media and because of the internet and how connected we are and the expectation of being connected. And so I don't ever want to be in a position where I'm trying to be divisive or trying to upset somebody or trying to be insensitive based on their own worldview or where they've come from. And
it sounds like maybe other people's feelings is
hard. It impacts me. And so I try to, it's a journey. We're all on a journey. And I think, I want to make sure that I'm trying to build bridges rather than burn them.
What's your relationship with the church at this point?
I love a lot of what the church does for people, especially like the services that they provide, like support in so many different ways. But every church is just like a person, and every person is different, and there are evil people and there are great people.
Yeah, like the church.
Right. I mean, but there is a big, you know, big capital C church that's out there. But I think ultimately that's like, you know, how do you feel about humans right now? You know, like it's just, they're all different. And there are amazing communities, and there are ones that are toxic, and toxic in a bad way. And so I feel like, spirituality and connection to each other is always going to be important to me.
Well, congratulations on this new album. It's really exciting.
Thank you.
Our time is up. Calvin Arsenia, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The album release party for LA Sessions is at the Record Bar this Thursday, and as we mentioned, attire for the show is Hollywood magic. That's a wrap. You can grab both of this morning's conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. And you can sign up while you're there to have all of these conversations sent right to you like a podcast for your listening convenience in case you're ever busy at 10 a.m. on a weekday. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, hear stories about life on the job from a live storytelling event we hosted around Labor Day. The stories of Kansas Cityans from all walks of life doing their jobs every day. And talk to us on Twitter. We are at KCURCST. We love to know what's on our listeners' minds, so chat us up. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Ann Kniggendorf, Aviva Okeson-Haberman, and intern Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.